Hi, everybody. My name's Sari, and I'm an emergency medicine physician, I'm here to tell you a little bit about some work I started with the Ghana Poison Control Center when I was doing fellowship training at the New York City Poison Control Center in medical toxicology, and this work has been and is still ongoing. And I'm going to tell you about one aspect of a program we started there in Ghana. I have no relevant financial interest to disclose, and I did this work. So estimated mortality rates from unintentional poisoning specifically are much higher in the developing world and even higher in sub-Saharan Africa than in most other parts of the developing world. And there are a lot of different reasons why this is so. Part of it is that there's poor regulation of very highly toxic substances, whether they're chemicals or medications, for example. So there's easy access to some fairly potent toxins, including, snake venom. People get bit all the time. There's a different epidemiology there. There's also very difficult access to medical care for financial reasons, social reasons. People may lack faith in healthcare providers, or they may have geographic limitations that prevent them from being able to get to medical care. And if they were to get to medical care, there's a lack of healthcare resources, and specifically human resources, really more than anything, because to treat acutely poisoned patients, which for the most part is supportive care, but the tools to do that and the knowledge to do that frequently is lacking. I began this work with the thought in mind that there are no accidents, that all poisoning is preventable, and that we really had an opportunity to try to mitigate things by working on the prevention side, even as a physician, I was trying to work within the medical establishment to shore up critical care capacity and build that. The question became as a toxicology fellow, well, if you want to do toxicology in Africa, what do you do? How do you know what to target? There really is there are not good reporting systems. We really don't know the epidemiology, and more specifically, we don't know the specific scenarios through which people become acutely poisoned. So what are the specific lived risks as opposed to snake bite or medications or whatever? And then the first time I went, I was struck that kind of no matter where I went, whether I was in the hospitals or in the world, and people said, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm an emergency doctor. And they said, oh, okay, we know what that is. And I said, and I'm a medical toxicologist. They said, oh, that's interesting. And the kind of faces went blank. And finally some people explained to me, well, we don't really have that here. People don't get poisoned here. I said, oh, really? And sure enough, in the hospitals, I found poisoned patients everywhere. But there was a general sentiment that this was not really an issue. And so I realized from the beginning that the problem, knowing what to target, was not simply one of not having good epidemiologic data about specific substances or scenarios, but also that there needed to be a lot of awareness creation in order to have a meaningful discussion with people so that they would do behaviors that we would suggest. If they don't think it's meaningful to them, they're not going to do it. They don't want to have the conversation. So with all these things in mind, I started out in 2009 performing a fairly qualitative needs assessment in the greater Accra region to try to understand what some of these toxicologic risks were. And I did this work with a group of global MPH students from NYU, and it was presented here in 2009. And for that survey, we had a semi-structured interview, and we went around and we talked to people in the community at bus stops, in hospital waiting rooms, on the streets, at the beach, and 19 healthcare providers. And we asked them, you ever been poisoned? What is poisoning? And who gets poisoned? And do you know anybody who's ever been poisoned? And what exactly happened? And what did you do? And what we found was that no matter who we were talking to, whether we were talking to people with no medical training or people with medical training who might have experienced patients with acute poisoning, everybody wanted to talk about the unintentional ingestion of kerosene by young children. Kerosene is a hydrocarbon, as most of you know. It's called paraffin in some parts of the world. It's been epidemic in pretty much every part of the world at some point in their development because it's a widely used fuel. It's used in lamps. It's used in stoves. It's clear. It's colorless. And if you stick it in a water bottle, which is how most people transport it, buy it, you know, reuse, recycle, you get your container, you stick it in the water, you know, bottle, you bring it home, you put it in your lamp, it can look like water, and for thirsty young children in hot environments who are toddling around and see that, they may well want to drink it. Unlike water, which has the organic chemistry of water, it's got this big, heavy oxygen atom and then a couple of hydrogen, so it's got this kind of dipole electrical force that allow the different molecules of water to stick together. So if you look at a faucet, you turn it on, there's like a straight stream of water. Kerosene doesn't have that because it's a whole bunch of carbon atoms with a bunch of hydrogens all around. It doesn't stick together very well. The molecules tend to fly all over. If you pour kerosene out of a jar, it's going to actually fan out. And if you try to drink it, the molecules, instead of going nicely down, are going to fly all over your mouth, and there's a high risk that you'll aspirate, that you'll breathe some of it into your lungs if it's in your mouth, just because of the physicochemical properties. So the big risk is a pneumonitis, an inflammation, and sometimes then a superimposed infection in the lungs that leads to respiratory failure. And what was interesting in talking to people about this is that when you talk to people in the community, you know, kerosene's an issue. Yes, I know somebody. 36% of the people we talked to in the community said, yeah, I know somebody like me, my family member, my, you know, neighbor, whatever, had this happen to them. And they all said, well, what we would do about it is we give them a whole lot of palm oil to drink until they puke. All right, to get the poison out. So what's wrong with this picture? Well, if you're going to aspirate it going down, you're going to aspirate it coming up. So this is like the last thing you want to do for kerosene poisoning, right? And when we talked to the healthcare providers, invariably, what was their experience with young children who came in? Yeah, their parents, they gave them the palm oil, they puked, they aspirated, they came in, and they died of respiratory failure. And what was interesting was that during the month that we were doing this survey, we actually had two cases of young children who had been fine for a period of 5 hours. Parents came home, older siblings said, younger sibling did this. They made them vomit, it was still in their stomach, they aspirated, and they died. And they would have been fine, because if you drink it, you basically, you know, have a really oily poop, and that's it. Doesn't hurt you. So this is what we found, and what we concluded was that there was a real opportunity to start a meaningful discussion with people in Accra about poisoning risks and poisoning prevention, but using kerosene ingestion as the target because it was salient. And we didn't know if there were more common or more serious, you know, poisoning scenarios, but this is the one that was meaningful to people. So we said, all right, this is how we're going to start the discussion. And there was a real opportunity to give both a primary prevention message, which is, you know, safe storage of chemicals in the home, and a secondary prevention message, which is don't force emesis in these cases. Call for help. You have resources. Let me tell you about what they are. Now, while we were doing this, we also asked people about how they got their health information and what would be a meaningful means of communication with them. Many of them said that if you were going to use media, radio would be the thing because we don't have TVs and we don't watch them anyway. But what most people said was that actually we get most of our health information from trusted other people that we talk to. They wanted to have some kind of face-to-face interaction with someone credible. And so we thought that, in fact, direct, you know, face-to-face teaching would be most meaningful. We wanted to use existing resources, and so we decided to develop a program that could be implemented using the Ghana Health Service, the public, you know, health system, and the Ghana Poison Center, which works within the Ghana, you know, Health Service, was very clear that they wanted a national program. And I thought, well, you know, we only did the needs assessment in Accra. We don't know what's happening in the rural areas. Why don't we just stick with something smaller? We decided to do a regional pilot and to design something that could then potentially be scaled up. The Ghana Poison Center staff didn't really have any experience with this kind of programming. They had been open since 2002. They were still getting getting like 14 calls a year. They weren't really talking to people and making those links, and they certainly didn't have any experience in public health programming or messaging. So I thought, well, you know, already the regional pilot seems a bit much, but we'll do it. And we asked all of the district level directors within the greater Accra region to nominate two people from their sites who could come and receive training and work with our program and bring it back to their centers and perhaps train others. We wanted community health workers working within the maternal and child health clinic system specifically because we thought that the targets should be mothers of young children, and that was going to be pretty much, you know, most of the population anyway, or those that would be responsible for the health of their families. We were interested in people who had nursing degrees because we thought that they would be in a better position to understand the kind of medical aspects of first aid and communicate those to others. And we thought we'd get two from each system because if we had a buddy system, then they might be more likely to feel comfortable going back and then sharing that information with other people if they had, you know, somebody else to work with on it. So a little bit more about the Ghana Health Services and why we were trying to work within this structure and you know what we learned. On paper, there's an administrative architecture that is three-tiered and fairly structured in its design. There are 10 regions in Ghana, and within those 10 regions, 177 districts. And the regional head is supposed to be the coordinating body both for clinical services and also for public health services within each region, and then the districts would report to that. So they serve as tertiary care referral centers within these regions and also as coordinating centers. And then there are these district-level clinics or hospitals and community-level clinics. There is more or less interaction between the public health side and the clinical side in different areas. And what we found was that even within the greater Accra region, and I know from traveling throughout Ghana that elsewhere it gets even more complicated, there is not a good overlay of the administrative architecture and the practical sites in which care actually is given. So the web of interrelations, communications, interactions is much more complex in practice than it would look like on paper. And in fact, even you know who's in charge of whom and where they're physically located within this system can be much more complex. In addition, there's an enormous variability in what these centers look like and what they're capable of. So you can have district level clinics that are, they have operating rooms and inpatient services and tremendous vaccination and you know community health programs with people who go and do outreach in the community and are, you know, community members with no training, but they work in, you know, churches or mosques or whatever. And then you can have district-level hospitals that are a little, you know, it's the side of a building with an awning and a poster, you know, and maybe a little table and a hook on the tree to weigh the babies. So there's tremendous variability even within this greater Accra region, which is where the capital is, at about 4 million people. What's nice is that the maternal and child health clinics are an overlap between the public health and the clinical side. They do a lot of antenatal care. They do the well baby checks. They do public health education with the mothers on nutrition, on hygiene, on all of these different topics. And so the group of people who work within them are already very well versed in methodologies for talking with mothers and communicating messages. They have a system down, and we said, well, let's use that. So in the end, we had 76 people who came to us, many more than what we had. that was more than two per site. That was like four per site. We gave them an 8-hour introductory course in basic medical toxicology, epidemiology, and poisoning prevention. And we asked them to conduct health talks with mothers about poisoning prevention in the home using a picture-based flip chart, which we designed using local people, actually the Poison Center staff's kids and mother, as models. to assist in the delivery about key messages. We also gave each a bunch of wallet cards, which I'll show you a copy of, that they would give as takeaways to the mothers that had the key messages printed on them, as well as the Poison Center contact information. We gave them informational posters to place on the clinic walls, and we gave each one a logbook in which we asked them to, it was a structured logbook, to record the sessions that they did. So I won't show you our full 10-slide thing, but this is this kind of summary slide at the beginning. So, you know, the main thing, message was keep kerosene away from children to avoid kerosene poisoning. And the big idea was that kids are attracted to kerosene if it's left out. They will drink it. Don't give them palm oil, but bring them to the clinic or call the Poison Center for information for a happy ending. We also showed them, there was one slide where it had the child either vomiting, being breathless, the different kind of signs and symptoms of kerosene poisoning that they were supposed to watch for, and that's what the Poison Center was going to tell them to do. This is the wallet card that we gave out. It is in English. There are about 26 different languages in Ghana. In the place where we were working, it's mostly either Tri or Ga that's spoken, sometimes Ewe, but and then Fanti and a bunch of other things because it's the capital, and so there are a lot of immigrants from all over. We didn't know how to really plan for that, so we decided to go with English, which is kind of the official language. of note, this front of the card is also another poster that we were handed out, and because it's got a mostly white background, in contrast to the other poster we had, this one was fairly cheap to produce. We could do photocopies, color photocopies, quite cheaply. So this was the most widely distributed poster, and what we found out later on was it was the image that was used to conduct the majority of the teaching by the in the end by the health workers. And I'll talk more about that later, but I just wanted you to have it in mind, kind of what that image looks like and how it depicts different forms of or different kinds of toxins which people might be at risk for poisoning with. So the outcomes we were interested in, we wanted to know, did they do it? You know, was there going to be any program uptake? But more importantly, because again, at the Ghana Poison Center, we didn't have any experience, they didn't have any experience with this kind of programming, we wanted to see kind of, well, what were going to be the barriers to implementation and how would this work and could we scale it up and use this as a learning experience for how to do programming in this environment. So we wanted to look at things like, you know, were there problems with material supply and distribution, time and space limitations, and we also wanted to know, were the materials effective? Did the mothers understand them? Did they feel comfortable with them? And finally, we wanted to know, you know, are these the right messages? Do people think that this is relevant to them? Are the images meaningful? Do the moms understand them? And do they think the recommendations are achievable or that we're completely out to lunch? So with these things in mind, we really had to design a mixed method study. We had an 18-item evaluation tool. Some of them were quantitative measures about, you know, how many people were trained and what languages it was in and how long did it take. But we also wanted to know really more qualitative information about the meaning and the achievability and how people related to these ideas. So we actually had to do a bunch of clinic visits to follow up on this and see, well, what does it look like when they do the training? You know, are they doing it? Do they do it comfortably? Wanted to interview the healthcare workers about their experiences. We also tried to review the logbooks for the quantitative measures, and all of this was done with ethical approval, both from here and there. So at 6-month follow-up, 39 of the 76 community health workers were contacted by phone. The others either had a wrong number or the phone had been disconnected. Most of them had been disconnected. People don't have plans. They have SIM cards and they change them out, so their numbers change a lot. Maybe that was it. I don't know. Or they didn't answer the phone. We gave them a bunch of tries over a one-month period. A couple times a week, we would call everyone on the list. We got through to 39. 16 of those had changed posts and therefore left the program. Or they had, you know, taken different kinds of jobs. And 23 of them said, oh, yeah, hi, of course I'm doing the program, come visit. And so we did. Of those 23, only two had filled out the logbooks and then incompletely. But they said that they'd been doing it. And when we observed they're doing the teaching, they seemed fairly comfortable with the material, and they had a thing, and you know, they were comfortable, they were grooved, they were relaxed. You know, they asked a bunch of questions, they had a methodology for doing it, and all of them had observations and comments, and talked to us for a couple of hours based on those experiences. They said that they had done it on of the people that we talked to, about once a week on average, so pretty much every time they had a clinic. They said that they did it as part of their thing. And again, there's huge variability. Some clinics meet once a month, some meet, you know, four times a month. So there was a lot of variability there. The audience in the clinics were mostly the postpartum mothers because they were coming for their well baby checks. So what happens is that, you know, you don't have a clinic appointment, you have a clinic day. And so as a mom, you bundle up your baby, you go to the clinic at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you hang out there until noon. So you're there with 30 other mothers, and everybody gets and there's a hook on the tree, and they weigh the baby, and they do the whole thing, and they give them the vaccinations if they need them, and then all the mothers are sitting around, and they're getting this teaching on different topics throughout all this time, right? So it's not the only program that's being done. It's one of two or three sessions that will go on, usually lasting about 25 minutes. Different programs will last more or less, but that's about the average amount of time. And they estimated that they had probably reached, as a group, about 1,690 mothers in that six-month period. I think these numbers are inflated because what happens is the moms come back and back, right? They're going to come back every week, and so, in fact, during some of the sessions, when it got to the point where they had the poster, the Poison Center poster there, the moms would pull out their wallet cards. They said, okay, so, you know, we're counting these people again. Of interest, six of the healthcare workers that we went to visit had never received their flip charts. These were people in kind of smaller, out-of-the-way clinics. You know, sometimes, again, the lean-to on the side of the building clinic. And so they had never gotten their flip charts or their posters or their wallet cards from the central distribution. There wasn't a lot of communication going on there with the directors. But they had the poster on the wall, and they were doing the teaching based on the poster. So really focusing and emphasizing on what is a poison, what are different types of poisons that you might have in your home that your child might be at risk for poisoning from, and then how do we prevent that. So it wasn't focused on kerosene poisoning so much, except in as much as the mothers would frequently bring that up as the thing in their home, and then the healthcare workers would be pressing them to come up with other poisons that they should also worry about and also store differently. The ones that didn't have the wallet cards, two of them told me that they had actually photocopied the poster and were giving it out to other people, but mostly didn't have takeaways for the moms. Everybody noted that they had tried to call the Poison Center staff either because they never received the materials initially, or because they wanted top up, or because they were concerned. They were telling people to call the Poison Center if there was a problem. Is this a real thing? Does it really exist? And we had the training. We brought them all to the Ridge Hospital so that they could see the Poison Center, that it really did exist, and meet the staff, and the staff were involved in the training. But they still didn't have faith that this was a real thing. And so they would call, and nobody would answer the phone. And this further kind of undermined the faith that they had in the Poison Center and that there was any kind of backup at the end of the line. Okay. They also noted many times that there was a lack of incentives to teach. There were some people that said, there's one woman out at Lagone Hospital that said, you know, for 15 minutes she told me, I do this work for Jesus. The children need this. You know, the children are dying. The mothers need to know this information. And she had gone around to a bunch of schools and started doing this education in the schools with the flip chart as well as during her session. So she was very, very motivated and loved this program and wanted us to continue. There were other people that noted that for the most part, their public health programming and their education is sponsored by the WHO or by USAID or by some other large organization, that frequently there's a whole staff and they have cars and they have uniforms and they get something small, which is, you know, they get top up, they get money from their salary to do all of this. And for running completely, you know, Ghana Health Services programs, they would like a little extra incentive to do that, and I think that might have been an artifact of me going to do the follow-up as opposed to the Ghana Poison Center staff. In terms of the content, they said the moms all readily understood all the images. They were able to identify risky situations as being dangerous. They related to the topic. They thought that it was relevant and personalized. They liked it that we used local images and local people in the materials. And then the discussion frequently generated requests for more information about other kinds of poisons, and I think this is because a lot of the teaching was relying on that one image that I showed you, or focusing on that. And in addition, the number one, when we asked them kind of, well, what, you know, what else, what questions do they have, what other things, you know, concerns do they have, they said, well, you know, they need more information on first aid. And they need more information on how to treat childhood injury. That's what they want. They also noted that moms thought that the image where we said, you know, safe storage was a box full of chemicals with a door that was half open that had a lock on it. And they all said, well, we don't have that. We don't have a cabinet. We don't have a place, you know, to lock this. And so they would talk about it. And there were a lot of interesting suggestions about how you do safe storage in the home there, including people insisting that you should always tuck your chemicals into the roof beam, into the roof, you know. One woman who had it, like, multiply wrapped in these black garbage bags, right, because to disguise it, because they didn't have original containers. They were storing all their chemicals in water bottles or whatever, but so that it had to be covered. So that was the out of sight, and then stick it under the bed or some other difficult to access place. Mostly they were concerned about the secondary prevention message. They said, so then what do we do? This is what we have always done. What do we do? And the idea of watching for signs and symptoms before acting, calling for help, or going to the clinic, these all seemed the watching was too passive, and they had no faith in the calling or the going to the clinic. So they really wanted active, at-home first aid strategies that they could use to help their children in the event of any kind of injury, whether it was poisoning or otherwise. That was what the desire was, and it was very difficult for people to think of doing nothing. And in general, they thought that going to the clinic seemed more acceptable than calling the poison center. Again, there was this lack of faith that anyone would answer the phone. So in summary, I think the program uptake was highly variable. Part of this had to do with just our inexperience in programming and relying on the district heads to nominate people, which I think was potentially in some cases done more on the basis of kind of seniority or availability as opposed to real interest. And so there's always a challenge, I think, when you're doing something of this scale between the top down and the bottom up, identifying local champions. The content was clear and relevant to mothers, but the specific recommendations raised concerns. And I think the safe storage one is kind of fine to leave as is, because there was a discussion around it that led to some creative solutions, and kind of I think their mom's local experimentation is probably going to be more interesting than any, you know, external recommendation anyway. There was a strong interest in first aid training and a lack of faith in the availability of outside help that I think is very interesting, and that we'll have to take into consideration in designing future programming. And so in summary, in thinking, well, how do we move forward from this? What were the lessons learned? I think we really understood that, we do have to strengthen the Poison Center capacity for education and outreach. This program was part of doing that, and it gave the Poison Center staff some good experience in how to do it. But I think they are very under-resourced from a manpower perspective and also from a financial perspective. Transportation issues, you know, they don't have money for gas to get around to these centers to go talk, and they don't have money for some very basic things like photocopying and laminating and so forth. So it can be difficult to figure out how to do that communication. I think in the future, I'd like to take a step back. The push is to scale up nationally. I think we actually need to scale down and to do some smaller pilot projects really in the community to get deeper qualitative information directly from the moms, perhaps looking at an assessment of poisoning risks in the rural area and combining that with a more in-depth analysis of what the healthcare structure is in those places and who we might identify as local champions for this kind of thing. And then potentially expand the program content into a childhood injury prevention program as opposed to a strictly toxicologic one. That's what I have for you, and I'm open to any questions. There was no remediation that needed to happen, partly because we didn't know who we were going to get. And so we decided to pitch it at the level of somebody who had some basic nursing training. So that, for example, a new nurse graduate could understand. So we de-emphasized a lot of physiology, and we're mostly focused on the kind of prevention messages about safe storage in the home, but gave a little bit of information about how different poisons worked so they could understand why we were making specific recommendations. When we sent out the letters and started working with the district directors to identify people who could be trainers, though, we were specifically asking for community people who were involved in the maternal and child health clinics as community health workers, but who had nursing training. And that is one pathway. It's not the only pathway, but that is one pathway to get into that line of work.
Interesting presentation. Thank you. I just wanted to know, in terms of the training, in what language was the training conducted?
Our training was the 8-hour training was conducted in English, because that is the language of higher education in Ghana. So anyone who's going high school, university, or any of the professional training programs will conduct all those studies in English, and that is the language of communication within the Ghana Health Services for all of their publications and so forth. So we did provide that that training in English, but the most of the trainings that were done in the community health centers were done in Tri, and then two places said that they were most of their population, they were using Ga, and one was using Ewe at one of the sites that they went to, but not the other. So the predominant language, which I was surprised, I thought there would be more Ga, was Tri, which is probably the most commonly used language in Ghana.
Can I ask, did the rehab worker nurses help develop the
So, no, they didn't. The Poison Center, the Ghana Poison Center staff, specifically Caesar, who is has a master's in toxicology, and Ed Ninepence, who was the medical director at the time, and his training, he's a physician, but he also has an MPH, and he worked for about 20 years in the kind of child health clinic as a GP, and they designed the images and piloted them with the just patients in the waiting room at the Ridge Hospital where they work a couple times. So,
well, the reason I was asking was, it seemed like if the issue of if I don't do palm oil, what do I do? That probably would have been something that might have come up in a discussion among the folks who are at the clinic level, you know, interacting with moms and babies.
Yeah.
Moms and babies. So
it did, and we anticipated it, and we knew it from the beginning.
Oh, you did.
Absolutely. This was not a shock to us or a surprise to us. We absolutely anticipated it, and we knew from the beginning that this was going to be the number one hardest thing it is worldwide. No one likes to be told to do nothing, and that is actually the message. But I guess there was also a kind of the Poison Center was using this program specifically, or was interested in developing this program specifically to augment their call volume. And so the recommendation to call the Poison Center first. So watch for these signs and symptoms, call the Poison Center. And then you may or may not be told to go to the clinic, was the message for political and political reasons. And part of that is, in the late 90s and early 2000s, the WHO kind of went around and tried to establish poison centers in a lot of countries in the world to try to develop a more robust surveillance system for understanding these injury trends, and also partly for surveying different products that would be implicated in those trends. Are pesticides being sold illegally? Are they being, manufactured with improper processes? Are we getting more cases in different parts? They need some mechanism for collecting that data, and this developing a more robust poison center network was how they decided to do it. So this poison center opened in 2002 with German development money and WHO funding. And the truth of, and since 2002, when I came on the scene in 2008, they were still getting maybe like 14 calls a year. Right, and they were largely sitting in an office, not really knowing what to do with themselves or how to become relevant in that environment. And I don't think anybody really knows whether the poison center model that has been effective in the United States and in Europe and in Australia is really the correct model for this kind of environment. And part of the reason why we were doing, why I've tried to make these assessments and programs a little bit more qualitative, is that I'm not convinced that it's necessarily the correct model for this place and time, and I think we need to be a little bit more creative and open-minded about how we structure this stuff. So,
I think it did show that, because what you wanted action. Watching wasn't viewed as action. Calling the poison control was viewed as action, but
they don't have faith in that. They don't have faith in that, and they don't have faith in their healthcare system to be able to provide them care in a timely fashion. They don't know that going to the clinic is the proper response either. And I think we know this intuitively from watching people's health-seeking behavior, and certainly as a clinician, the people I see coming into the emergency department have been sick for 4 days. They've done a lot of stuff, and they've gotten a lot of help from pharmacists, from herbal healers. They have tried so hard before they come to us. And that's really, you know, addressing that head on and empowering them to do that and to do a better job with that is probably going to be more interesting in the short term than any other message we can give them, because the truth of the matter is that the Ghana Poison Center staff is not in the office. They don't have enough people to answer the phone 24 hours a day, and they don't have the training and expertise to really be able to give good advice all the time necessarily, because, you know, they're working with limited information. They don't necessarily always have internet access to be able to, you know, find the specific recommendations that we have available to us at our fingertips through, you know, high-speed internet, and they might be waiting to download a page on some, you know, esoteric chemical that may or may not be labeled. They may not know what it is. So it can be very challenging from multiple perspectives for them to do the kind of job that we take for granted in our practice environment. And then in the clinics as well, they don't necessarily have access to the kinds of resuscitative equipment that we do. And without that consistently demonstrated outcome, people may not want to seek care there.
Very interesting to the patient. Thank you. And being from Sub-Saharan Africa myself, I can totally relate to the kerosene. Growing up using it, you know, it never dawned on me that it could be a cause of poisoning. Maybe because people don't even look at it as poisoning. You know, it's not talked of at all. But I was curious as far as like the statistics that you found out besides the kerosene. What are the forms of poisoning actually in Sub-Saharan Africa? I'm just curious.
Statistics, I wouldn't say statistics, because there are hospital-based studies, right, that have been published. There are some very active groups in Tanzania and in South Africa, for example, looking at poisoning epidemiology, and then scattered reports from all over. But those hospital-based studies, even though they might get the sickest people, I think they may be misleading with regard to the breadth of what exposures are. And my experience has been that the numbers are invariably misleading, and that it's just very difficult to collect those kinds of data. That said, I would probably estimate that snake bite would be, you know, clearly in the top, right, for acute poisoning and for serious morbidity and mortality and dailies lost and all that stuff. Carbon monoxide, I believe, is probably an under-recognized and large problem. There are some reports now where people are starting to look at this, but there are large groups, you know, of people who live in fairly enclosed small dwellings and will cook inside, or who will use smoke as a way to dispel mosquitoes, and so they're inhaling a tremendous amount of particulate matter and also carbon monoxide, because they're burning carbon-based fuels. And I think, you know, in general, we don't know a lot about the chronic effects of carbon monoxide poisoning, but then even the acute cases, if they do become obtunded, they might be diagnosed with cerebral malaria without even thinking about it, you know, and the ability to kind of sort that out and diagnose CO is not there. Medications are problematic in pockets and spurts, sometimes because of adulteration or contamination, but also misuse and therapeutic misadventures, as we like to call them in toxicology. And then I would say pesticide poisoning. It's not the same problem in sub-Saharan Africa as it is in Southeast Asia, where there's a tremendous amount of intentional ingestion of pesticide. It does happen. And it's, you know, but I wouldn't say it's common in that environment. I don't think people do that for self-harm so much.
Thank you. Hi, thank you again for your international presentation. It's not often that we get a chance to see the international perspective in our session here. I think I have a question, but I need to understand something before I ask it. Were these CHWs nurses, or were the trainers nurses that trained CHWs?
So I think CHW, as it's used in different contexts, might mean different things. In Ghana, there are people who are lay persons in the community who do health programming, who have some role in health programming, but they're not everywhere. And a lot of the people who do that kind of outreach in different community settings do have some kind of medical training and are not employed in a clinical capacity. The nurses, the community health workers that we trained were people who were functioning within that public health system, not within the clinical system, but they had nursing training. And the idea was that they would then hopefully go back and teach other people in their clinic environment to implement the program and not necessarily be the implementers themselves. And in fact, what we found was, I think that I only really spoke to two people who had received the training where there was good evidence at the site visit that they actually had trained other people to implement the program. I think the others had, you know, been doing it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then my question has to do, because there is a huge population of lay peer model CHWs in Ghana,
mm-hmm.
largely working around HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, exactly.
Implement their programming to meet people's realities. And so I think my question is, and I think you hinted at it a little bit, but I'm wondering if it's part of your published findings. The CHW model, well, the nursing medical model is a service model. Come to us, we'll sell you a service. The CHW model includes more capacity building empowerment approach, where it's, we want to help you learn what to do about this yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to come to us. I think community health workers feel successful when they're not needed anymore. And so I'm wondering, it seems like your population is telling you, we want to know what to do. We don't want to come to you for service. Help us learn what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know that it's a difficult nuance for the medical community to understand that people don't want to come to them. But
actually, we really, really love it when they don't want to come to us and when they know how to do that safely.
Right. So my question is it part of your intent to publish that finding?
I don't think we're there yet at that level of the programming. So again, the initial intent was to use these people who already work with those types of community health workers that you're talking about, who actually don't ever come to the clinic. They're purely in the community, right? We were hoping to use our trainers as that link because they already serve in that capacity in other programs, like for the HIV and TB and so forth, and I don't believe that layer actually happened through this mechanism. So again, you know, there were a lot of lessons learned about programming. And how to disseminate this information for political and practical reasons. We were using an existing resource that we had access to through the Ghana Health Services because the Poison Center is also part of the Ghana Health Services, and this was really a Ghana Health Service program. And I think in the future we might investigate other mechanisms of communicating with these more traditional community health workers, but this method of dissemination hasn't, I don't believe, gotten to that step. Yeah. There were two people who did seem to have done that, but only in those two sites. Yeah.